From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Congressman John Lewis wasn't just a civil rights icon, he was an American legend. He died on Friday. He was 80 years old. Lewis's final public appearance was on June 7th of this year at Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington. So today we're going to talk with people born long after the 1960s on the lessons they're drawing from his life. But first, let's listen to Lewis himself, remembering what it was like being a young activist on a massive national stage. On August 28, 1963, he was just 23 when he stood beside Martin Luther King at the Lincoln Memorial, the youngest speaker at the historic March on Washington. He was introduced that day by A. Philip Randolph.
I have the pleasure to present to this great audience young John Lewis, National Chairman, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Brother John Lewis.
When A. Philip Randolph called my name or introduced me, I went straight to the podium. Then I said to myself, I said, I must go for it. And I started speaking.
We march today for jobs and freedom. But we have nothing to be proud of. For hundreds and thousands of our brothers are not here.
Well, I had the pleasure of speaking with Congressman Lewis at length back in 2013, and we want to hear more of that conversation now. We started by talking about what had happened earlier that summer in 63, when civil rights leaders first told President Kennedy that they were planning to march on the nation's capital.
That was back in June, when we met with the president. A. Philip Randolph, this dean of black leadership, this prince of a man, spoke up in his baritone voice, and he said, Mr. President, the black masses are restless, and we're going to march on Washington. And you can tell by the body language of President Kennedy, he didn't like the idea of someone talking about marching on Washington.
The march hadn't even been formally planned at that time, right?
Not at all. But the idea, he saw, of bringing hundreds and thousands of people to Washington. He said, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be violence and chaos and disorder? And we would never get a civil rights bill through the Congress. Mr. Randolph responded and said, Mr. President, this would be an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent protest.
You were just 23 at the time.
I was 23 years old, had all of my hair, and a few pounds lighter.
You were speaker number 6 on that day. First of all, just tell me what you saw.
Hundreds and thousands of young people, students, volunteers, black and white, up in the trees, trying to get a better view. Then I looked straight ahead. I saw many, many young people and people not so young with their shoes off, their feet in the water, trying to cool off on this hot August day.
Now, your speech, Congressman Lewis, on that day, many people think that it's actually as memorable, possibly, as Dr. King's was, because Dr. King gave this resounding sermon, almost, about hope and dreams in America. Is it fair to say that your speech was something of a counterpoint about the reality of what was happening in the South at that time? I mean, in the speech you say that we come here today with a great sense of misgiving.
It is true that we support the administration's civil rights bill. We support it with great reservation, however. Unless Title III is put in this bill, there's nothing to protect the young children and old women who must face police dogs and fireholders in the South while they engage in peaceful demonstration.
Basically, because you didn't feel that enough was in the civil rights bill to protect people against violence in the South.
I thought it was a little too little and too late. And down in the body of the speech, I said, listen, Mr. President, listen, members of Congress, wake up, wake up. You're trying to take the revolution out of the streets and put it in the courts. I said, you tell us to wait. You tell us to be patient.
We are tired. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We're tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom, and we want it now.
But what people really didn't like near the end of the speech. I said something like, if we do not see meaningful progress here today, the day may come when we will not confine our marching on Washington, but we may be forced to march through the South the way Sherman did, nonviolently. People say, oh, no, you can't say that, John. And it was Martin Luther King Jr. who said to me, John, that doesn't sound like you. And we deleted that from the speech.
And yet it was still so passionate and forthright. I'm asking you about this because we're speaking a half century later, and it's very easy with that kind of distance to look back on momentous events like this through kind of rose-colored lenses, isn't it? And yet in 1963, there was horrific violence. There was no guarantee, as President Kennedy said, that the Civil Rights Bill would be passed.
Well, 1963 was an unbelievable year. Hundreds and thousands of people had been arrested in jail. Bull Connor, the police commissioner in the city of Birmingham, had used dogs and fire hoses on people, little children, on women. We had to act. We had to do something. I remember the morning of August 28, 1963, before we made it to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. We met with the leadership of the House, the leadership of the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans. And then we started walking down Constitution Avenue. We saw hundreds and thousands of people already marching. Now, we were supposed to be their leaders. It was almost like saying, there go my people. Let me catch up with them.
To me, one of the most powerful and plain-spoken moments of your 1963 speech was when you talked about your frustration with the political process. I mean, you said,
by and large, American politics is dominated by politicians who build their career on immoral compromising and ally themselves with open form of political, economic, and social exploitation. There are exceptions, of course. We salute those. But what political leader can stand up and say, my party is the party of principles? For the party of Kennedy is also the party of Eastland. The party of Javis is also the party of Goldwater. Where is our party?
How much of that misgiving do you think remains true today?
Oh, I think in American politics, so much is that still exists today. First of all, there's too much money. Too much money. We sell and buy election like we're selling soap. Maybe, just maybe, we should come to that point and have public financing and take money out of American politics.
Easier said than done.
It is easier said. It's very difficult to get it done.
I saw you in a New York Times video a couple days ago. And when it comes to race in America, you said it's better now than it was in 1963. And that got me thinking, isn't that also what Chief Justice John Roberts was saying when he wrote that decision overturning key parts of the Voting Rights Act? Because I'm looking at his opinion. And he writes, our country has changed. While any racial discrimination in voting is too much, Congress must ensure that the legislation it passes to remedy that problem speaks to current conditions.
We have changed. We have made progress. But we changed. We made progress because of the Voting Rights Act. Without that act, we wouldn't be where we are today. But before the ink was dried on the paper, states like North Carolina, Texas, Arizona, Mississippi, tried to take us back. I don't want to go back to the days of the literacy tests. The vote is precious, almost sacred. It is the most powerful, nonviolent instrumental tool that we have, and everybody should be able to use that tool. I know people who died for the right to vote.
Congressman Lewis, you were the last living person who gave a speech that day. Is there any part of you that's concerned that there is a page turning now in American history past that moment of this great social upheaval when it came to equality or reaching for equality in America?
I'm deeply concerned that the present generation failed to grasp what happened. That's why I think it's so important for young people and those not so young to understand that there's a role for them to play. I have this feeling that people are just too quiet. They need to make some noise.
You've got a new book out. It's a new memoir. It's called March Book One. And you've chosen an interesting format to tell this story. What format have you chosen?
Well, we have decided to make it simple, make it plain.
It's a graphic novel.
It's a graphic novel. And you can almost taste or feel or smell what is happening. You know, talk about my parents telling me, don't get in trouble, don't get in the way. And Dr. King and Rosa Parks inspired me to go out there to get arrested. The first time I got arrested, I felt free. I felt liberated. I want young people to read it and to be inspired. Because years ago, a comic book came out back in 1957 called Martin Luther King Jr. and the Montgomery Story. Sold for 10 cents. I read that book. It inspired me. And it inspired the four students who took seats at a lunch counter on February the 1st, 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. We all can make a contribution. We all can get in the way. We all can get in good trouble, necessary trouble, to change things.
So what is the unfinished work of August 28th, 1963?
That we must complete what we attempted to do during the 60s. Open up America, open up the society, and let everybody come in. And end discrimination based on race and color, nationality, sexual orientation, and create what I like to call one house, the American house. We all live in the same house. We're one family. We're one people.
Congressman John Lewis, speaking with me in 2013. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Congressman John Lewis. He died on Friday at the age of 80. We're not only talking about his legacy, but how to push that legacy forward. Now, Lewis, of course, was congressman from Georgia for decades, so let's go to Atlanta, where Rose Scott joins us. She's host of the midday news program Closer Look on WABE, Atlanta's NPR station. Rose, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So how is Atlanta mourning and observing the death of Congressman Lewis?
As I would expect from Atlantans, it's remarkable. It's emotional. It's a celebration. It's remembering. I tell you, for me, it's being on social media and seeing all the pictures people have with Congressman John Lewis. I have a picture with him. It's like everybody in Atlanta has a picture with Congressman John Lewis, and I think that speaks to the type of person that he was, politician aside. I have a friend who posted a picture of him. He was coming out of a grocery store, you know, with a basket full of groceries, and she said, you know, we spoke for 30 minutes. Those are the stories that I'm hearing, whether you were a notable or someone that just lived around the corner from him in his neighborhood. You felt like you knew him. Everyone has a John Lewis story as if they were friends for many, many years. And I think that that is something to be celebrated. I think that Atlantans are really showing, if folks did know or if folks wanted to even, you know, judge whether or not, was this man really like this? Yeah, you check in with folks in Atlanta right now and you'll see.
Now, I'm seeing that people are flocking to this beautiful, enormous mural of Congressman Lewis that's in Atlanta. They're laying flowers and remembrances there. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
You know, Atlanta is a city of wonderful creatives. I mean, just some brilliant artists, poets, musicians, you have it. Brilliant creatives. And you'll see murals all throughout the city of leaders, of people who are admired. I mean, even outcasts, they've got a mural. You know, why not? You know? So when something like this happens, people come out and they show their love and their respect and their admiration. And also a way of saying thank you. People I've been talking to since Saturday and even today, and we're putting the finishing touches on a program, our midday program. It's all about reflecting on what this man has meant beyond just being Congressman John Lewis, but from such an early age during the civil rights movement and being tasked. You know, he wasn't just a foot soldier. He was tasked with leading campaigns and organizing at 23 and 24 years old, and people being able to see him make this. They walked along the journey with him, you know, from being on a, you know, Atlanta City Council to, you know, to congressman. This is what he has meant to Atlanta. This is what he's meant to Georgia. So these creatives, you know, when they put these murals up, you know, I say, look, if you got a mural, you must be somebody special. I don't have one yet, but I'm okay with that.
Well, I mean, the mural is fantastic. And I think just to the left of it, there is a quote from his 1963 speech from the March on Washington. And, you know, it's an amazing speech. You heard my conversation with him back in 2013 a little earlier. And he, of course, even at that time, remembered it word for word. But what I love is the section of the speech that the mural chose to highlight, because I think it speaks so much to Congressman Lewis's moral authority in this, you know, across decades in the United States. It's the portion of the speech where he said, "I appeal to all of you to get into this great revolution that is sweeping this nation. Get in and stay in the streets of every city, every village and hamlet of this nation until true freedom comes, until the revolution of 1776 is complete." So I just talk about that for a second, about the longevity of his work, coupled with the fact that he was calling on America to realize its founding principles for all Americans.
That's what you call leadership. And that's what you call moral leadership. And I just finished a conversation with Dr. Robert Franklin over at Emory University, who's written many books on moral leadership. And I always ask him to remind our listeners, you know, what are those characteristics? What are those attributes when we talk about moral leadership? And I'm going to do him justice here by hopefully getting it right. But he talks about the big four, which is integrity, courage, imagination, and wisdom. And I think that sums up perfectly Congressman John Lewis. You know, the moral leadership that he displayed as a 23-year-old, 24-year-old, it's the same that he had when he was 80. It's the same that he had when he led a sit-in, you know, in Congress. It's the same that he had when he is speaking to, whether it's a group of Morehouse or Spelman students, or he's speaking to someone at the grocery store. The same message. The same message. And it's always embedded with integrity, with courage, imagination, and wisdom. Always the same.
Yeah. Well, one more question for you, Rose, about how this weekend has really hit Atlanta, because on the same day, I think just hours apart, as Congressman Lewis died, Reverend C.T. Vivian also died at home in Atlanta. Of course, he was a trusted advisor to Dr. King, later led the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I mean, how much has the two of them passing on the same day really rocked the city?
You know, it's been a jolt, I think. But when speaking with one of their fellow civil rights activists and longtime friend, Zenora Clayton, who was an aide to the King family and also worked with the SCLC, you know, she told me, you know, they went together. She said they probably planned it. She said, but they went together. And I think what I hope people take away is when you think of John Lewis at 80 and you think of C.T. Vivian at 95, they still, they were still active. I remember a couple of years ago when Atlanta had like 14 people running for mayor, And I covered a press conference where C.T. Vivian and Ambassador Young were endorsing a candidate. And they were still the same message, still talking about the importance of leadership for this city and still reflecting on their time in the civil rights movement. And if you ever had the opportunity to spend time with either one of them, no matter what the setting, it always went back to them asking you, so what do you do? What are you doing? And I remember one of my first conversations with Congressman John Lewis was actually had nothing to do with politics. We were both attending a National Black Arts Festival celebration for the wonderful, wonderful, legendary Ruby Dee. And anybody that knows me knows I don't wear dresses a lot. But got all dressed up, you know, because all these notables are going to be there. And I had to get this picture with Congressman Lewis because I, for so many years, I'd wanted to meet this man and so many other people. And that's a great thing about starting my career here in Atlanta. I moved here in 96, and I knew about this city's history, its rich history. And so I was prepared to meet some of these notables. But until you actually can sit down and have conversations with them, that it really hits you that how lucky you are as a journalist to be able to hear these stories from the mouth, to hear the narrative that they're telling you. And so, but when I met Congressman Lewis, we ended up talking about our favorite movies with Ruby Dee. So that was pretty cool, you know, for me. And then when you think about that, there aren't too many left of that circle, you know, we're blessed to have Ambassador Young still with us and Zernona Clayton, you know, and I believe Reverend James Orange's wife is still with us. So, you know, if you have an opportunity to sit down and hear these stories and collect these stories, I think that you'll be just impressed and really sort of just immersed and hanging on every word.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when I had that chance to talk with Congressman Lewis extensively in 2013, Rose, that's exactly how I felt, because he was telling me stories which we know he's told 1,000 times, but he looked me straight in the eye and told it to me like it was the first time he was telling anyone, with detail, with humor, with heart. And thinking back, it was so yet another one of those moments where it was so evident that he considered part of his work, his ongoing work, to be sure to do everything he could to be sure that younger people know those stories, right? That they understand their import. And that was, he took a lot of, I think, pleasure and seriousness in trying to sort of hand down those stories across generations. And so that's what we want to talk about more for the rest of this hour, sort of like how to take those stories, that legacy, and push it forward. But in order to do that, first, let's just go really way back in his life a little bit, because there's a terrific documentary called Good Trouble. It's a documentary about his life. And here's a scene from that documentary where Congressman Lewis describes a certain group of livestock on the farm where he grew up in Alabama, how those animals were more attentive to his message than fellow congressional colleagues were in the decades that followed.
We used to raise a lot of chickens where I grew up on this farm. I wanted to preach so much, told we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard. And my brothers and sisters and cousins were lying outside of the chicken yard. And I would start preaching to those chickens. They would bow their heads. They would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But they tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues on the other side listened to me today in the Congress.
Congressman John Lewis in a scene from the documentary John Lewis, Good Trouble. Well, Dawn Porter is the filmmaker behind that documentary, and she joins us now. Dawn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what it was like to make this documentary with Congressman Lewis.
Well, I'm really enjoying your conversation this hour, and it's very much as you describe. Sometimes when you meet people that you admire so much, it's hard to think of them as people, as individuals, as human beings. And so when you spend time with Congressman Lewis, you see, you know, the ferocious kind of, you know, powerful speaker that he is you know, just one part of his personality, and the rest is, you know, he, it's hard to get used to saying was, but he's funny and warm, and I'm, you know, just really enjoys people and sharing, and his kindness is expressed in so many small ways. I think the public knows about the large ways, his marches, his legislation, but the small ways are just as important. How he greets people, that he remembers to ask about your family, about your children. Those small things are important too.
Mm-hmm. Well, so can you tell us more then about what he either said or the things that he did, where it's clear that he has been mindful for a long time about, I don't want to call it necessarily his legacy, because I don't think he saw it that way, but the continuation of the work of the realization and expansion of civil rights for all Americans, how mindful he was about trying to raise up and educate younger people about that.
Yeah, I think you see that expressed in a number of ways. Certainly what, you know, leaps to my mind is his mentorship of new congressional members. So, you know, one of the things he did before the swearing in of the new caucus was to, you know, to kind of hold meetings with some of the people that we show in the film, Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Representative Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, Mayanna Presley. And those meetings were really important to him to explain that people, when you're starting in Congress, your role has changed, but your motivation can stay the same. So, you know, as someone who made that shift from activist to legislator, his tutelage, I think, really resonated with those new members. And also, you know, I think he encouraged them to have the freedom to bring their activism with them into the Congress in a constructive way. So as a congressperson, you really have the power to get things done, you know, and you're ability to sway opinion is so important. And so he, you know, they all spoke about how meaningful it was to have him, you know, address how they could move forward in their activism. So I think that,
yeah,
that is, you know, a huge gift to all of us who are looking to them to continue. We need more people to be a John Lewis, to be the conscience of the Congress, as Congresswoman Pelosi says of him.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think you both heard in that rebroadcast we just did of that my 2013 interview with him, and I want to emphasize the date. It was 2013. But at that time, he was unafraid to say that he wondered if the younger generation was a little too passive, because, I mean, we were hot off the Supreme Court's decision in the Shelby case that gutted a couple of sections of the Voting Rights Act. And so he was really, he had talked in several interviews that year about needing people to be more active. Of course, in 2020, it's a different story. And he himself, Congressman Lewis himself, said in June, to see all of the young people, Black, white, Latino, Asian American, Native American, standing up, speaking up, and being prepared to march, they're going to help redeem the soul of America. Rose, I'm wondering, how would you describe what the relationship was between Congressman Lewis and, say, activists in Atlanta?
Well, for the younger activists, and I think you and I had a conversation not too long ago after some of the protests here, you know, there's an admiration there. There's also a disconnect, because for some of them, obviously they weren't alive and they may be two generations removed from the works of John Lewis and so many in the civil rights movement. But there was an admiration, and there was this notion of, yes, we can borrow a template, we can borrow a blueprint, Now, there were some times where some of the young activists would say, well, you know, their time is gone. Now it is up to us and we're going to do things a little differently. But I think there's a difference in terms of when you want to disrupt, and there's probably nothing wrong with disruption. Destruction is something else. And I think that is probably where, for some people, trying to make this distinction between, you know, good trouble and then when trouble goes, you know, down a different road as it relates to some turning violence. But at the end of the day, what I will tell you is I know there was a lot of respect and admiration for Congressman John Lewis from a lot of young activists here. I've spoken to them, and while they may have some different methods, but they understand the importance of the work that he did and what he was trying to relay to them in terms of good trouble.
Yeah. Well, Rose Scott, stand by for just a moment. Don Porter, director of the documentary film John Lewis, Good Trouble. Fred, we have to let you go, but Don, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani. And this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Congressman John Lewis and how to push his legacy forward. And he himself, in fact, expanded his work on civil rights, of course, very focused for the entirety of his life on racial justice, but he expanded those core concepts of what it means to be an American and bringing civil rights to all Americans to other issues in the United States over decades, including, for example, fighting gun violence. Here's Congressman Lewis in 2018 speaking at the March for Our Lives rally in Atlanta.
I gave a little blood on that bridge in Selma, Alabama, 53 years ago for the right to vote. And as students, as teachers, as parents, get out there. Send those folks home who cannot vote against guns. Send them home. Send them home. Bring them home. Do it. You can do it.
Congressman Lewis in 2018 at the March for Our Lives rally in Atlanta. The congressman was also very outspoken in his support for legalizing gay marriage. He told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that that was a fight for the extension of civil rights and a natural extension, he said, of the movement for racial equality. And he explained that with a quote from Dr. King.
When people would ask Dr. King about interracial marriage, at one time in the state of Alabama, black people and white people could marry, or in the state of Virginia, some of the other southern states, other parts of our country. Dr. King said, races don't fall in love and get married. Individuals fall in love and get married. So if you're going to have an equal protection under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, you cannot say it's good for some people and not good for other people. You cannot have equality for some and not equality for all.
It's Congressman John Lewis quoting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as one of the reasons why he was a champion, that John Lewis was a champion for the legalization of gay marriage in this country. I'm joined today by Rose Scott. She's host of the midday news program Closer Look on WABE, Atlanta's NPR station. And joining us now is Kwame Rose. He's with us from Baltimore. He's a social activist, writer, and artist as well. Kwame, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm wondering, tell me, what lessons from John Lewis's life and legacy do you find yourself carrying forward or applying in your work?
You know, it's interesting. When this all first happened, I think I tweeted something the older I get, the more I realize that we would not be here without the contributions of those before us. And we look at the life and the legacy of John Lewis. And this is an individual who dedicated their entire adult life to serving others, to fighting for a better change. I look at John Lewis as being a bridge. Without him and what he did over the past 50 years plus of his life, we would not be here in this moment today. And even as you mentioned in your interview with him, calling out younger generations in 2013, who knew that a movement of this magnitude would have sparked? So the way I could sum it up is that John Lewis put the I can in American. And he showed that not only can we raise hell in the streets by protesting, but we could raise moral and ethical questions in Congress and push forth legislation. Our country lost a hero. Our country lost a giant, one whose path is not checkered by immoral ideas and practices, but one who gave their life to make this country what it has the potential to be.
Mm-hmm. You know, before 2020, he would, I heard him often reflect on maybe the frustration that young people have with the political process, given what politics are in this country in this day and age. But he repeatedly also said that that politics is the thing that has it controls what the impact is going to be on every American's daily lives. And he exhorted young people to not give up on politics or the political process. Do you believe that, Kwame? Do you feel like ultimate change for this country must come through the political process?
No, I don't think that ultimate change comes through the political process, but I think that change happens at a multi-layered facet. Congressman Lewis started in the streets. He started from marching. He started from sit-ins. He started with getting arrested. And then he ultimately transformed over into politics. So I don't think that politics is the end-all, be-all. But I will say that the only way that we will make progression is when it comes time for the election in November, is that all the folks that are out protesting, and particularly white America, this is a black man who was beaten, who was incarcerated for standing up for the rights of his folks so that no other group of people has to go through what black people have gone through in this country. And there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of white folk who've been protesting over the last few months. We need those individuals to go back to their communities and to take those folks from their communities to the polls and vote in a way that is beneficial to black people, folks in this country, to brown folks in this country, to the LGBTQ communities. Because the only way we would defeat Donald Trump is if people stand up to the face of, in the face of white supremacy and hatred, something that has guided this country for 400 years, so that other individuals don't have to dedicate over 50 years of their life to making sure groups of people have what is due to them as human beings.
Mm. Well, Kwame Rose, social activist and writer in Baltimore, Maryland. Kwame, thank you so much for coming back to the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Rose, did you want to reflect or respond to what Kwame was saying?
Well, as a journalist who covers all of the above, I think that it's the pattern, it's the trend that we probably expect to see. Young folks have been the backbone of leading a lot of movements. And if they can take something from John Lewis, the blueprint of the civil rights movement, now, of course, they didn't have social media, obviously, back then, but that has been so instrumental for folks. So I think there is something there. This is the trend. This is a pattern. This is what we expect, right? This is what we want from those coming after us to make it a little bit better. Just like my generation, I'm a Gen X. I'm very happy about that, you know. But folks like John Lewis and everyone else in the civil rights movement made it just a little bit better for me, right? So now... Mm-hmm. It's my job as a journalist, and whatever way I can do that and still hold truth to the tentacles of my industry, you know, I've said it before on this show, my job is to be fair, not necessarily objective, so I'm going to be fair. But also, when you see wrong happening, You have to, you need to disseminate that, and you need to tell the people that. That's my job as a journalist. And for the other folks who can get out in the street, protest, and raise fists, and bring awareness, and you know, make change, that's what they're supposed to do. So in our own way, no matter what path we're on, I think we all can strive to be better. I think we can all take something from the likes of John Lewis, no matter what industry you're in.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, Congressman James Clyburn told us today that one of the things that he remembers deeply from the 60s was when that movement in the streets was essentially hijacked by bad headlines in the press. And so he did not want that to happen again, this time in 2020, which is one of the reasons he and Congressman Lewis very quickly came out and said that language around, quote-unquote, defunding the police wasn't necessarily language that they supported. They wanted to focus on the ideas itself more deeply. So actually, on that note, let me just spend a couple of minutes here now with someone who worked quite closely with Congressman Lewis on issues of policy in Washington. Andrew Iden joins us. He served as digital director and policy advisor to Representative Lewis and also was co-author with John Lewis of that 2013 graphic memoir series, March. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, if I may, I just want to actually dig straight down into one very particular piece of policy, because of course, Congressman Lewis, as a young man, in the march from Selma to Montgomery in 1965, and the violence that ensued when the marchers were attacked, that is the thing that accelerated the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Can you tell me how, just briefly, how Congressman Lewis felt when many decades later in 2013, we had the Shelby case at the Supreme Court, which rolled back parts of the Voting Rights Act, and that kicked it back to Congress itself to try to restore what he had fought for decades earlier?
That was a difficult day. I remember being in the office, and it hadn't hit the television yet, and he was in his office watching it. And I got the email alert that the Shelby decision had come down. And he said, "Is it here?" And I just said, "Yeah." And then I shook my head. And he put his head down a little bit, and he said, "Okay, well, we've got to get to work." And that was John Lewis, right? There was no setback that he couldn't overcome. There was no challenge that he was afraid of. And I think when the Shelby decision came down, as he said, it stuck a dagger in the heart of the Voting Rights Act. And to him, it was, he looked at it in the context of the long arc. I mean, the Klan actually marched in their largest march in Georgia in more than 40 years, 4 or 5 days after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. That was their reaction. So he'd been fighting back against the forces trying to weaken or eliminate the protections of the Voting Rights Act since the very first day after its passage. And this was just another challenge to him. It was brutal. It was painful for him to see. But I think in his mind, right, it was just another fight that he was going to give his whole self to.
Yeah. You know, he viewed history on that long arc, for sure. But, you know, from 2013 to December 2019, when the House passed the vote, they formed legislation in 2019 and passed the Voting Rights Advancement Act in December of 2019. Here we are in August 2020, and Senator McConnell hasn't even allowed it to come to the Senate floor for a vote. Certainly, did Congressman Lewis ever? He had to be frustrated with that. I mean, how long does the arc have to be?
I think he was frustrated, but I think he was always an optimist, right? I think he would get great pleasure out of the fact that Senator Leahy's renaming that bill after him. And I think if his death puts any pressure on the Senate to act and to finally do the right thing, that would be something that would mean a lot to him. But you got to understand, John Lewis was a perpetual optimist. No matter, even when I would get down, when we would have struggles in the office and there were things that we were working on and we couldn't get it done, he would just put his hand on your shoulder and he'd say, "It's all going to work out, son. It's all going to work out." And that's how we got to passage of the Voting Rights Act to begin with. I mean, you got to look at Selma in the context of, I mean, his own organization didn't want him to march. Jim Foreman was saying, you can't march as chairman of SNCC. And he said, I'm going to do it anyway. I want to be there for the people of Selma. And I think so long as we keep our mind and our vision on the fact that we are looking out for people, that humans are imperfect, but they all have humanity that we have to fight for, then we just keep moving. We keep moving forward. And I think there will be a day when we'll look back and John Lewis will have been the shining light that guided us to a better America.
Hmm. You're going to miss him a lot. I can hear it in your voice.
I was listening to the audio clips you're playing, and it's just like hard not to cry. He was like my dad. He would call me his son. We did a lot. But the thing that I miss so much is that this was a person who was never afraid to take a risk for the right thing. You know, we look back on, you talked a lot in the show. I listened about how the young people today went from being, what the congressman said, a little too quiet in 2013 to now marching in the streets. And I think it came from a place of not knowing what happened during the civil rights movement. I think it came from a place where they just didn't understand the power that they had. And that was part of why John Lewis wanted to do the graphic novels, why he wanted to write mm-hmm. March, so that we could show them the history, we could show them exactly how the tactics were originated during the civil rights movement, so that they could apply them to today. And, you know, one of the things he was so proud of was the fact that March is now taught in all these schools. So you're talking about in 7 years, you sort of changed the calculus for how many students grow up just understanding what the civil rights movement was and exactly how the tactics were, or even being introduced to the philosophy of nonviolence. And then in that time, all of a sudden, you see that once you show that to the young people, they do show up. They understand their power. They protest, and they're active. They write letters to their members of Congress, and they put more pressure on their elected leaders than I think any generation since John Lewis's. And when you look at it in that long arc that he sees it from, that's how this is supposed to work. That's how America works. You find new ideas, new ways to tell the story, new ways to dramatize the conflict, and then you pass the baton to the next generation. And that generation takes it, and they move us even further. And sometimes we have to fight to protect what we gained, but I think in this moment, for as frustrating as it may seem to some, I think in this moment we're on the cusp of a great change, that this is a great awakening that's about to happen in America.
Hmm. You know, Congressman Lewis said that in the period of the 60s, he felt a call to wrestle with the soul of America. And I juxtapose that against what he says about young people in 2020, that they are the ones who will redeem that very soul. It seems as if, you know, sort of he's the shoulders that the people working now are standing on. I mean, Andrew, we've just got about 10 seconds left here. Your quick thoughts about that.
I think John Lewis will go down in history as one of the greatest American heroes. And I think it will be the love that he showed for his country, his people, and the system of democracy that we created that he'll be remembered for and that we have to lift up and teach every generation about.
Well, Andrew Iden he was a digital director and policy advisor to Congressman Lewis and also co-author of the marvelous graphic novel series about the congressman's life called March. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew. And Rose Scott, we got to wrap up here today, mm-hmm. but I know I'm going to want you back on this show. Rose is host of the Midday News program Closer Look on WABE in Atlanta. Rose, thank you as always.
Anytime.
This is On Point.